From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Merry Christmas. On today's Fresh Air, we begin our holiday week series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway. We'll hear an interview from our archive with the late songwriter Burton Lane. Most of his songs are written for films, but he also wrote the music for the shows On a Clear Day You Can See Forever and Finian's Rainbow. His songs include How About You, Old Devil Moon, Too Late Now, and How Are Things in Glaucomora. We'll also hear excerpts of two Fresh Air concerts with the late Susanna McCorkle, featuring songs from movies and shows, including a couple of Christmas classics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Christmas turned out to be no day of rest for Americans stationed in Iraq, with grenade, rocket, and mortar attacks launched by insurgents throughout the day. NPR's Julie McCarthy is with the troops in Baghdad and says the increased activity came as no surprise.
U.S. military officials were warning that they suspected that there would be some sort of display like this, a kind of what they call a psychological intimidation that the insurgents would try to pull off. And indeed, it seemed to have been a very well-organized, very noisy, and sustained set of attacks. Having said that, the damage seemed to have been minor, and there were no fatalities.
NPR's Julie McCarthy reporting from Baghdad. European mission managers are waiting for a signal from the $70 million Beagle 2 Mars lander. The spacecraft entered the Martian atmosphere on time, but nothing has been heard since then. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
NASA says only one out of every three Mars missions makes it safely to the Red Planet. Japan's space agency lost the half-ton Nozomi probe earlier this month. Beagle 2 is just the latest in a series of missions to Mars, and it's the first from Europe. The science station is designed to take three-dimensional pictures of the red rocky surface of Mars. It will also use a robot arm to scoop up soil samples to look for organic material. Mission managers chose to bring the craft down on a spot on Mars called the Isidis Planitia, which is believed to contain sedimentary rock created by flowing water. Beagle 2 and NASA's twin Mars rover, set to land in January, are targeting places where water may have provided a convenient place for life to exist. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
In Brooklyn, New York, volunteers put on a holiday dinner for the less fortunate today. Lee Perlman, who organized the 13th annual holiday dinner at the YWCA, says about 4,000 meals are being served to people who are homeless or among the working poor.
People like being in a situation where they feel they're part of other family. And quite frankly, people are happy to be in a position where they can get a toy for their child. But the children here today, this is the first and only toy they're going to get today.
Perlman says the event also provides warm clothing for those who need it. Similar dinners are being served to homeless people around the country. Scientists in Britain have confirmed that a slaughtered cow in Washington state did have mad cow disease. A tissue sample from the diseased cow was sent to Weybridge, England, where pathologists have extensive experience in dealing with the brain-damaging infection because of outbreaks in Britain. U.S. investigators are trying to trace the history of the dairy cow to find out how she might have been infected. Scientists say the infection can incubate 4 or 5 years before it shows up in a sick cow. Investigators say the cow may have been infected by eating feed that was made partly from an infected cow. The Department of Agriculture has issued a recall for more than 10,000 pounds of beef. This is NPR News. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf has survived another attack on his life, the second in less than 2 weeks. 14 people, mostly passers-by, were killed and many others wounded. The president later appeared on television and said the attack was the work of extremists. The BBC's Paul Anderson reports from Islamabad.
This latest attempt to kill President Musharraf was sophisticated, coordinated, and very close. Two suicide bombers in pickup trucks packed with explosives tore out of separate petrol stations and drove into President Musharraf's convoy as it passed. One connected, but not with the president's armored limousine. Most of those killed and injured were passers-by. The attack happened close to the bridge which bombers blew up 11 days ago, seconds after the president's convoy had passed. Pakistani officials refused to be drawn on who might be behind the attack, but suspicion will fall first on Islamic extremists, angry with the president for his support of the United States.
The BBC's Paul Anderson reporting from Islamabad. A Palestinian group calling itself the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing that killed at least 4 people today at a bus stop near Tel Aviv. More than a dozen people were wounded by the bomber, who blew himself up during the evening rush hour in an industrial suburb of Tel Aviv. It was the first suicide bombing in Israel in almost 3 months. Earlier today, an Israeli helicopter fired missiles at a car in Gaza City, killing a senior Palestinian militant and 4 other people. The Israeli army confirmed the attack and said the man who was killed was a commander of Islamic Jihad who was allegedly planning a terrorist attack in the near future. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Merry Christmas. We're celebrating the holidays with a week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway. We begin with a 1990 interview I recorded with composer Burton Lane. He wrote mostly for movies, but he also wrote the songs for the shows On a Clear Day You Can See Forever and Finian's Rainbow. Some of his best-known songs include How About You, Old Devil Moon, Everything I Have Is Yours, I Hear Music, Too Late Now, What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life, How Are Things in Glacamura, and You're My Thrill. He collaborated with some of the great lyricists of his time, including Ira Gershwin, Yip Harburg, and Frank Lesser. Lane died in 1997 at the age of 84. When I spoke with him, he had just teamed up with singer Michael Feinstein to record the first volume of the Burton Lane songbook. The album opens with a song that Lane wrote with the lyricist Ira Gershwin for the 1953 film Give a Girl a Break. Lane and Gershwin made a demo recording of the song in 1953, with Gershwin singing his lyrics and Lane at the piano. We'll hear that original demo, then seg into the recording featuring Lane and Feinstein.
When the voodoo drum is drumming, or the hummingbird is humming, does it thrill you? Does it fill you with delight? To continue with this jingle, are you one of those who tingle to your shoesies at the bluesies in the night? Oh, the sounds of bugles calling, or Niagara Falls are falling, may enchant you, we will grant you that they might. But for us on the stage, oh brother, there's just one sound and no other. Applause, applause, we like applause because it means when it is striking us, the audience is liking us. Our work demands you don't sit on your hands, and if the hand's tremendous, you send us. We live, we thrive, you keep us all alive. With bravo and bravissimo, we're dead if it's pianissimo. Our quirk is work, is work we never shirk, in a happy land of tinsel and gauze. Because we like applause.
Burton Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me a little what it was like to record with Ira Gershwin.
Well, working with Ira was a dream. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. I can tell you, would you like me to tell you a little story about how this came about?
Absolutely.
Ira was known for turning down assignments. When I had the offer, when I was received the offer from Irving Lazar that MGM wanted me to do a score for a film, he said, who would you like to work with? I said, I'll give you 2 names because I know my first choice will turn the assignment down. I said, my first choice is Ira Gershwin, and then I gave him a second choice. 2 days later, I got a call that Ira had accepted the assignment. And I, of course, I was thrilled. I had known the Gershwin since I was 17 or 16 years old, and this would be the first time that I would be working with this giant. And as the day approached for me to start work with him, I started to get very nervous about the whole thing. I was wondering, am I up to this? Am I good enough to work with a man like Ira? The day I was to meet him, I took a sedative to calm my nerves. I was that shaken and that nervous at the prospect. When I got to his house, we engaged in some trifling, just very flimsy conversation just to get kind of loosened up a little bit. And I sat down, played a couple of melodies for him. And as the hour wore on, I started to feel more comfortable. And I said to him, "Ira, I have a confession to make. I was so nervous at the prospect of working with you that this morning I had to take a sedative." Ira reached into his pocket, took out a pill box. He said, "I had to take one too."
You said that you met the Gershwins when you were 17 years old. How did you meet them?
Well, my folks used to take, my father used to take my brother and me and my mother to Atlantic City over a holiday weekend or a holiday week, like Christmas and New Year's. And we were having dinner at a very modest hotel in Atlantic City. My father was a person who, when he saw a piano, he would say, "Bert, play," and I would cringe. And he saw a piano. It was an upright piano that was facing a wall, and the people who were having dinner would be looking at the back of whoever was playing. And he finally used enough pressure for me to go to the piano. I said, "I'll do it if you sit alongside of me." So he was sitting facing out into the room, and I was facing the piano, which was against this wall, an upright. When I hear a woman's voice saying to my father, "Is this your son?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "My name is Rose Gershwin. I'm George Gershwin's mother. I was attracted to your son's playing because he sounds like George. And when I looked to see who was playing, he looked like George from the back." And it was this introduction which led to Mrs. Gershwin calling us when we got back to New York and inviting us to an open house to meet Ira and George, which happened. And it was a very meaningful meeting for me.
Songwriter Burton Lane is my guest. Your songwriting career starts at around age 15 when you were signed to a Tin Pan Alley music company. What was the job exactly?
Actually, my first contract was with the Schuberts. They were producers of Broadway shows. J.J. Schubert had heard some of the songs I had written and signed the chap I was working with, who happened to be my brother's friend, who was going to law school at the time, to write the score for a Greenwich Village Follies starring James Barton. Barton got sick and the show never happened, but we wrote a score for it. Later, as soon as that was over, I was introduced to the head of Remick's music publishing company. I was signed to a contract, a songwriter's contract, in which I got $17.50 advance each week. George Gershwin had also been signed by Remix, and he got $15 a week. So I was getting more than George got.
How old were you?
I was 15.
How did you get to Hollywood?
Irving Berlin's publishing firm signed Harold Adamson, wonderful lyric writer, and me on a six-week deal to see if we could get some songs in pictures. And it was his firm, Irving Berlin's firm, which sent me to California with Harold.
And what was the first movie you did?
My first movie was Dancing Lady. Now, I didn't write any songs for Dancing Lady. Metro purchased three songs that we already had written. And it was also Fred Astaire's first picture. And the picture starred Joan Crawford, Clark Gable, Fran Chartow. And Fred Astaire was just starting out as a performer in films. He had been a star on Broadway, but nobody knew him in the picture business.
We're listening back to a 1990 interview with songwriter Burton Lane. Here's Billie Holiday singing "Says My Heart," a song composed by Burton Lane with a lyric by Frank Lesser for the 1938 movie Coconut Grove.
Chance, says my heart. but each time that I'm almost in your arms, this old school teacher brain of mine keeps ringing in false alarm. Then my head rules instead, and I'm wise to the scheme of that gleam in your eyes. So I kiss and run, but the moment we're apart, oh, you fool, that was love, says my heart.
Billie Holiday recorded in 1938. More of our 1990 interview with songwriter Burton Lane after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with the late songwriter Burton Lane. His songs include Old Devil Moon, Everything I Have Is Yours, How About You, How Are Things in Glacamora, and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever.
One of the things that happened shortly after you got to Hollywood was that you heard a young girl who turned out to be Judy Garland sing, and you kind of discovered her and played for her audition.
Yes, I did.
What did it mean to discover her? Where did you hear her, and what did you like about what you heard?
I was on the contract to Metro. This is 1934. And one night I went down to downtown Los Angeles to the Paramount Theater, where there was a film and a stage show. On the bill were the Gum Sisters, and they were two young women, I guess 19 and 21, something like that. For a finale of their act, they brought out their kid sister, who was 11 years old, Frances Gum, who sang two songs, Zing Went the Strings of My Heart, which was a very good song, and a Hebrew melody which had been done by many people in vaudeville called Ailey Ailey. And she was just wonderful, so wonderful, I thought, that I went out into the lobby of the theater and I called the head of the music department. This was at night, and I called him at his home, told him about this young girl, and he said, well, see if you can arrange to have her brought out to the studio. We'll audition her. Which I did. I went backstage. I met her father, arranged for her to be brought out to the studio the following week. And she arrived about 9 o'clock in the morning. I took her over to the office of the head of the music department. I played her audition. And the audition went from about 9 to about 7 or 7:30 that evening. Because after Jack Robbins, who was head of the music department, heard her, he called L.B. Mayer, Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of the studio. Mayer came down with an entourage of people. We went through the numbers again. He said, I want every director, every writer, every producer to hear this child immediately. And that's how we spent the day. I played her audition. We must have gone over these numbers 15 or 16 times until everybody who was intended to hear her heard her. The next thing I knew, of course, she was signed. They loaned her out, and some peculiar way, I didn't see Judy for 7 years. After a year or so, I was let out. I went over to Paramount for a couple of years, and in 1941, was brought back to Metro to write the score for Babes on Broadway, starring two great stars, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. So Judy became, in those 7 years, became a great big star.
One of your best-known songs is from that movie, and I'm thinking of How About You.
Yes, it was sung by Mickey and Judy, and of course they did it beautifully.
But I want to play you playing it from the new album that you recorded with Michael Feinstein, and there's about a 2-minute piano solo that opens this recording of it. Do you want to say anything about performing this for the new record?
Well, in the film, Ralph Fiedler wrote the lyrics, and I wrote a patter which came between the first chorus and the third and the second chorus. And it was Michael Feinstein who remembered this and suggested that I do a piano solo of that patter, which I did recorded on the record. And I think it was an interesting idea, and I think it turned out very well.
Well, I do too. Why don't we hear it? Composer Burton Lane at the piano playing his own song, How About You. You know, there's so many times when I thought, oh, this must be a Gershwin song, because the line, I like a Gershwin tune, How About You?
That was my line.
Was it really? Yeah. Oh. You know, the one problem with that line is that it makes you think Gershwin.
Well, you should. It was the whole idea. So, I mean, when you're listening the things that are important to you, I like New York in June, How About You? I like a Gershwin tune. What tune would be more important than a Gershwin tune?
So how'd you come up with the line? And why did you come up with the line? Someone else wrote the lyric. Who wrote the lyric for that?
Ralph Fried. It just popped into my head, that's all, and I blurted it out. And, of course, Ralph liked it immediately.
I think it's the best-known line from the song.
Well, I'm delighted with that.
You've worked with a lot of different lyricists. With each lyricist, did you have a different way of working?
No, not really. Mostly, I would write melodies first. Yip Hallberg was not one who would write a lyric first. He would give me a title. For instance, in Finian's Rainbow, the title, When I'm Not Near the Girl I Love the Girl I'm Near, came first. With Alan Lerner, I would sometimes he would give me a few lines of lyric or a title, and I would write to the title. But most of the times, it's been music first. With Ira Gershwin, I think the lyric of Applause, Applause, he wrote that lyric first, and I said it. But most of the times, I would say it's music first.
Were there any lyrics written for any of your songs that you were frankly unhappy with?
Well, I think there were, but I don't think they wouldn't be published. I wouldn't let them get out. You know, when you're working with a lyric writer, of course one has to be gentle and considerate because they're trying to do a good job. But if it isn't right, you have to be honest with one another. One of the first things I say to any lyric writer I start working with, we must be absolutely honest. I don't want to be yesed into a flop. If you don't like a melody, tell me. If there's some part of the melody you don't like, I'll change it. And I must have the same freedom with lyrics. And that's usually agreed to without any problem.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And I also want to thank you for writing so many great songs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Burton Lane recorded in 1990, 7 years before his death. It's part of our Holiday Week series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway. Here's Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney singing How About You from the 1941 film Babes on Broadway. The music is by Burton Lane, the lyric by Ralph Fried. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
But the note they end on will depend on little pleasures they will share. So let us compare. I like New York in June. How about you? I like a Gershwin tune. How about you? I love a fireside when a storm is due. I like potato chips, moonlight motor trips. How about you? I'm mad about good books, can't get my fill. And Franklin Roosevelt's looks give me a thrill. Holding hands in the movie show when all the lights are low may not be new. I like it. How about you? I like Jack Benny's jokes
to a degree.
I love the common folks.
That includes me.
I like to window shop on Fifth Avenue.
I like banana splits, late supper at the Ritz. How about you?
I love to dream of fame. Maybe I'll shine.
I'd love to see your name right beside mine.
I can see we're in harmony.
Looks like we both agree on what to do.
And I like it. How about you?
I'm so delighted I've ignited the spark within you. Let me continue to make it burn.
With you I will be like a drill bee, so let's not dally. Come on, Svengali, I've lots to learn.
When you're a rising star, exercising daily.
For example, just a sample.
Bend and touch the floor 50 times or more.
A fine start to be a Bernhardt.
A dictionary's necessary, but not for talking. It's used for walking the Ziegfeld way.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, our week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway continues with excerpts of two concerts featuring the late singer Susanna McCorkle. We'll hear a couple of Christmas classics that were written for movies. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're celebrating the holidays with a week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway. We're going to listen back to excerpts from two of the concerts we recorded with the great singer Susanna McCorkle. She took her life a couple of years ago at the age of 55, but she left a legacy of wonderful recordings. Many of her favorite songs are written for movies and shows, and she had a gift for making you hear old songs in new ways. Her first visit to Fresh Air was in 1987, when she performed with Ben Aronoff at the piano and Chip Jackson on bass. I want to welcome all of you to Fresh Air. And Susanna, before we talk about your music, would you sing a couple of songs for us?
I'd love to. The first one I want to do is my little tribute to Fred Astaire, a wonderful singer people think of as a dancer, but all those of us in music treasure his records, and songwriters loved writing for him because he was just a guy singing. He didn't impose himself on the song. He really gave a lot of attention to the lyrics and the music. So this is for Fred.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits, putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits, putting on the Ritz. Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Super duper, come let's go where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts, putting on the Ritz. Where fashion sits, putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits, putting on the Ritz. That's where each and every Lulu Bell goes. Swell bows, rubbing elbows, come let's go and we'll attend a jubilee and we can spend our last two bits putting on the Ritz.
One of my favorite lyricists is Yip Harburg, who tried to put his humanist politics into his songs and the shows that he wrote for. And I had the pleasure of meeting him when I was making a tribute album to him. I found out he lived right around the corner from me in Manhattan. I was terrified of meeting him. I'm always scared of meeting all the songwriters. And he was a bit forbidding because he was really worried that nobody young would understand his songs and what they were about and if they were supposed to be funny. But once he saw that I really knew a lot about his songs and extra lyrics and obscure songs, he opened right up. He was really wonderful and showed me a lot of unusual music. He did his own show toward the end of his life, and he always used to sing If I Only Had a Brain from The Wizard of Oz. I took another verse from The Wizard, from that same song that was sung by the Cowardly Lion and the Tin Woodsman and the Scarecrow, If I Only Had a Heart. And I was fascinated when he said that when he and Harold Arlen wrote the score for Over the Rainbow, they really tried not to talk down to children. They did adult songs. They didn't think of kiddie songs. And maybe that's why the songs have lasted so well, because this one seems really almost a song with an 80s sensibility. It seems to me that it could be a song about just being in touch with your feelings.
An empty kettle,
she should be on her mettle, and yet I'm torn apart. Just because I'm presuming that I could be kinda human if I only had a heart. I'd be tender, I'd be gentle, an awful sentimental regarding love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy that shoots the arrows if I only had a heart. Picture me, a balcony above. Voice sings low, wherefore art thou, Romeo? I hear a beat. How sweet, just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I would stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart. If I only had a
That's beautiful. Susanna, you have just a magnificent voice. And I'd like to take a few
minutes. Actually, so do you, Terry.
Let's take out a few minutes to talk before you sing some more songs. And, you know, I've been listening to your records for years, but I know very little about you, so I really want to find out some more. When did you start singing popular songs?
Well, I grew up always really loving songs. I used to listen to them on the radio, and my mother had a lot of Broadway show albums in the days when the music was just sensational, of My Fair Lady and West Side Story and things, mid-50s and earlier South Pacific and Finian's Rainbow. So I always was fascinated by the stories in songs. I used to lie on the floor listening to them and figuring out who was singing them, why they were unhappy or what or happy. And I went through the 60s, like everybody, trashing all that and thinking it was stupid and establishment and boring. And it wasn't really until I went to Europe as a disenchanted youth in the mid-60s that I rediscovered, or really discovered for the first time, the richness of American popular culture, especially of the 30s and 40s, in movies, movie musicals like Fred and Ginger, Busby Berkeley, and dramatic movies like Double Indemnity and Sunset Boulevard. That was all new to me. And also old jazz records from the 30s, Duke Ellington and earlier Billie Holiday with the small group records of the 30s, and earlier Bessie Smith. And I became really fascinated by them and thought that there was a whole country that I hadn't known about growing up, and it must still be there, at least in vestiges. And I just really wanted to get with people who appreciated those things.
What happened in Europe to show you this kind of music that you had ignored during a period in America?
Well, it was the music of the intelligentsia there, really. It was the snob appeal at first, because I spent time with students and artists around my age, and they really knew so much about Charlie Parker, you know, jazz, and the records were readily available, even in the chain drugstores and supermarkets there. You could buy a Billie Holiday record for the equivalent of $2, and it was just more readily available. But I really only had to hear a Billie Holiday record once to know that she was something very special, and it was a tradition of singing that I felt deserved to be kept alive, very direct and honest, instead of either stagey and theatrical or folk music, which had a kind of innocence and guilelessness, but it wasn't really musically very sophisticated, or the Supremes, top 40 stuff. It just seemed a whole other way of singing and approaching music that I just loved. I was really ready to hear it, and it hit me like lightning.
After singing those kinds of songs in Europe, when you came back and when you were reunited with friends and family, were they really surprised at this new kind of material that you were doing?
Well, There wasn't really anybody to be reunited with. You know, I didn't have any friends from college, and I was living on the other side of the country from my parents. I just felt as if...
You changed your life then.
I did. I felt as if I didn't belong to anything. And then when I discovered jazz, I felt I belonged to jazz. It was like a tribe. And I was one of the strays who finally found my home tribe. And it always, at first I lived in England. And I lived in London for a while. And I immediately felt that way. I had a shared sense of humor. And there were other things, different books that we liked, politics, movies, even foods. I felt, boy, these are my kind of people. And they were always here, but I just didn't know about them. And I still really feel that way, as if I'm a daughter of the tribe who has to pay my dues and go through certain things to be considered worthy of belonging to this tradition, you know. And I do love that feeling. I think Americans, at least WASPs like me, have a certain rootlessness. And that's, I found that popular music was my root, something good I could belong to and carry on.
We're listening back to a 1987 concert with the late singer Susanna McCorkle. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're celebrating the holidays with a week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway. Let's get back to our 1987 concert with the late singer Susanna McCorkle. She was accompanied by pianist Ben Aronoff and bass player Chip Jackson.
Susanna, we'll talk some more in a few minutes. I'd really love for you to do another song first.
Okay, well, I know you have a very arty program with lots of literary figures, so I'd like to do a song that would never have been written if it hadn't been for one of the great literary figures, George Bernard Shaw. I'm sure even he would have approved of the way Lerner and Lowe interpreted one of his plays. I've grown accustomed to his face. He almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune. He whistles night and noon. His joys, his woes, his highs, his lows are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in, I was serenely independent and content before we met. Surely I could always be that way again, and yet I've grown accustomed to his looks, accustomed to his voice, accustomed to his face. I'm very glad he's just a man and so easy to forget. Rather like a habit I could always break. And yet I've grown accustomed to that trace of something in the air, accustomed to his face.
Singer Susanna McCorkle, your singing and your phrasing are really both magnificent. Do you have any formal training or anything?
I don't have any. I just always grew up singing in school choirs, which I think was great, to always just be confident about opening your mouth and singing. And we used to sing in the car a lot. We used to sing rounds. But the one time I tried, I was living in Rome, and I thought I should learn about breathing and scales. And so I had a friend who studied classical singing, and I went to the teacher who taught her, who was named Maestro Ricci, and he had pictures of Anna Moffo kissing him, John Sutherland kissing him. I knew he was the wrong one, but he insisted that he could teach me, and he told me wear a surgical corset and hold, you know, he'd whack my jaw, macella morbida, you know, he says keep your jaw relaxed, and I was so intimidated I couldn't even say I didn't really want to sing opera. And finally, after a few lessons, he said, "I'm so sorry, really, you're a well-educated young lady, you speak good Italian, but you will never be a singer. You have a tiny, tiny thread of a voice. I'm so sorry to be the one to tell you this." And I was really so relieved. You know, I said, well, really, I didn't want to sing opera. I wanted to sing, you know, Gershwin. I tried to think of composers he'd identify, and he said, "For this, you have enough of a voice already." You know, so that was really my only brush with vocal training. And I always do scales every day. I do 3 octaves of chromatic scales. And I try to keep in good shape, exercising, breathing. But as a jazz musician told me later in London, you know, if you just let go and make people feel song, nobody's going to worry about whether you read music or breathe right, you know. And many people have even said how good you didn't train, because I think there's so much emphasis on training that people tend to sound just alike. So, and my favorite singers just have a natural rough-edged sound. So even though sometimes I envy virtuosi who just have huge voices, I do notice sometimes you tune out of a voice like that. You just stop listening to the content in a way you would never do with Nat Cole or Billie Holiday or Ray Charles or somebody who's just more unique and kind of rough.
Well, your phrasing is also very personal, and it also seems to come from your heart.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I never consciously think of phrasing. I think of lyrics and the person I am singing the song and just try to feel the song and not be too intellectual about it.
So you had this short-lived period of taking lessons, which was a disaster. But you liked to sing. You sang in the course. When did you actually start singing or think that you would be a professional singer?
Well, I did some summer stock in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They had shows, Bye Bye Birdie and Lil Abner. And I sang in those, and I liked singing, but I didn't like doing the same thing the same way every night. So for a while, I just didn't sing at all. I thought it had just been a school kid thing. And I was in a choral group at the University of California, but I hated it. It was 99 girls singing hymns and Rodgers and Hammerstein mainly. I said, what is this? So I just stopped singing. I didn't even have record player or anything. It was really Billie Holiday, I have to say. Billie Holiday made me want to be a singer.
Did you ever fear when you started gravitating toward popular song and toward some of the classic composers that maybe you'd missed your time?
I've always felt really glad to live in the time I lived in, because I was in a very interesting political time at Berkeley and a very good time for women. I guess I would have been a starlet band singer if I'd been in the 40s, but I wouldn't get to be the woman that I am now, more independent, traveling and living alone in Europe. So I feel really good about it. I feel people said I was crazy to do that kind of music when I started in the early 70s, but that now people are ready to hear that. So I feel that I'm lucky that those records called out to me that way, and I wanted to heed the call.
The late Susanna McCorkle, recorded in 1987 with Ben Aronoff on piano, Chip Jackson bass. We'll hear an excerpt of her 1988 Christmas concert after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. During this holiday week, we're featuring songs from Hollywood and Broadway. In 1988, Susanna McCorkle returned to Fresh Air to perform a concert of Christmas songs. We're going to hear a couple of Christmas classics that were written for the movies. Accompanying Susanna was pianist Lee Musiker and bass player Dean Johnson.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together. If the
That's always such a sad song. It was actually an even sadder song I just read in one of those books of Hollywood anecdotes that you're always so ashamed of yourself for reading, but you keep on reading. When it was written by Blaine and Martin for Judy Garland, she said, "This is too sad. It's a sad moment. Our family's about to move to New York. We're afraid we won't be together again after this Christmas." But the words are so sad, this Christmas may be our last, and if I sing it sad and the song is sad, it'll be too sad. So just make it more neutral, and then I'll be sad, and then it won't be too much of one thing. I love that idea of Judy Garland sitting down with the songwriters and talking about it, the idea that you could be there when a great song is born, and as a singer who really thinks about what you're singing, have something to do with it and to say about it. And it is really enduring classic song that... we just don't get tired of.
I think it's one of the best Christmas songs.
It is.
I'm glad you opened with it.
Christmas is sad. There is always a longing about Christmas, longing for what we never knew, even, except from the movies.
What's your next song?
This is by Irving Berlin. He was the best at writing holiday songs. And this one we have the verse, which is not usually heard. It makes the song a completely different song, not just about a Christmas with snow, but about going back home and having the kind of Christmases you used to have and remember best and love best. The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day in Beverly Hills, L.A. But it's December the 24th, and I'm longing to be up north. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Just like the ones I used to know. Where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear
The late Susanna McCorkle recorded on Fresh Air in 1988. Many of her recordings are still available. Our week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway continues tomorrow.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, lyricist Sheldon Harnick. He wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof and She Loves Me. We'll also hear from singer Barbara Cook, who starred in the original Broadway productions of She Loves Me and The Music Man. Join us for the next Fresh Air.